Hi, everybody. My name's Tammy, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here this evening. Heck, I'm grateful to be anywhere this evening sober, that's for sure, because it wasn't always the case. I want to start by thanking the committee for asking me to come out and share. I especially want to thank Ben and Shaylin, who, you know, if you've ever been a part of planning one of these things, it's endless, endless hours and months of work. And I know the other speakers will vouch for this, and that we can tell when conferences are really well run and smooth, where every little detail has been thought of. And I can tell you, this is, to the committee and to you people, this is a really well run, well thought out conference. So I want to thank you all for that. And I want to thank Dana, my hostess. Dana showed up right on time, and it took us 14 hours to fly here because there was a lot of layovers. We actually went to 4 states to get here, and that's what we do, so I'm not complaining, but I could tell you when you get off the plane and you meet somebody and there's a friendly face and they're there waiting for you, that's a really big deal after 14 hours, and she's been on time. She's been there for us. A lot of times they give speakers a bunch of candy and chocolate, and I don't eat all that stuff, and so we had, like, fruits and oranges and just so well thought out. So I want to thank her, and she's doing that commitment of taking us. Unfortunately, it takes hours for us to get back because we moved to this tiny little small rural town, and they only have one flight in a day. And so I have to leave at 5 a.m. on Sunday morning, and she's actually getting us to the airport, like leaving at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I really want to thank you. That's quite a commitment. She may not have known that. You do now. And, you know, I also want to thank Dane and Rhonda. I don't know if they're here tonight, but we were hosted the most the most beautiful breakfast this morning. And these people just Dana and Rhonda opened up their house, and all of us were there, and the food was, like, unbelievable. And my husband and I and the other speakers that were here at the time were able to attend, so I want to thank them. You know, it takes a lot of people to do this. I also want to just start by thanking the other two speakers that have spoke before me. You know, man, Cliff, like, knocked it out of the park, right? But there's one thing I do want to correct. Cliff seemed to feel the need to explain to us women what the inside of a male bathroom looked at. And I want Cliff to know, if you're an alcoholic woman... And I'd like to further extend that, you know, his rule of not peeking? We don't have that rule. And I want to thank Taryn for her talk. Oh, my gosh, I so identified, and so raw and so real. And, you know, it's taken me, and I know the other speakers know, it's taken me, I'll have 31, I don't want to say God willing, because God is always willing, but Tammy willing, I'll have 31 years sobriety next month if I don't pick up a drink. And it's taken me almost 30 years to be able to get through my talk without crying. Because, you know, the one thing you have to remember as an audience, to you guys it's an AA story, but to us it's our kids, and it's our spouses, and it's our lives. And if you're here tonight to be rolling on the aisles and entertained for some funny, wild, crazy AA story, hate to disappoint, but we hurt people. And there's nothing funny about acute alcoholism. And are we happy, joyous, and free, and we learn to be that in Alcoholics Anonymous? You're darn straight. But, you know, I'm going to tell you right now, if you've had one person in your life not cry 1,000 times, 100 times, 50 times, cry more than 2 times over your drinking, and we continue to drink, then like the book says, like Cliff said, it's not my opinion, you're a selfish, self-centered human being. Look, there is no shame in being an alcoholic. God, none of us wanted to grow up and just destroy and break the hearts of everybody that ever loved and cared for us. The shame is that we got a book and a room full of people that would go to hell and back with you if you want to stop drinking, and the shame is when people don't grab it. So you're here in the room tonight. You're here in the room tonight because you're grabbing it, and just hold on to it. I'm going to get into my story really quick. I do want to start with the AA stats. My sobriety date is April 24th, 1993. I've been accused of name-dropping or whatever. Don't care. I got the mic tonight. my home group was the Pacific group, but I share this now because Clancy was my sponsor until he passed away almost 4 years ago. Don't care whether you like or love him, but what I can tell you is what he did for myself, for my husband, for countless others, and for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, I will always be deeply indebted to him. And I honor my old-timers that went before me, so I always try to mention his name. And I want to share about my friend Lee. He hates it when I do this, but, you know, my sponsor, Clancy, did not go buy me, like, trinkets and, you know, posters and book covers or all of that. I would be going through something in my life, and Clancy would just go get somebody's tape. A lot of the people even sitting in these front rows that are your speakers. And they might be going through something I was going through. And that old boy would just come to the home group, the Pacific group, and he'd say, "Young Tammy, come here." And I'd walk over, and he'd pull something out of his pocket, and he'd just hand it to me. And then the next day, my call time was always 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was a high school English teacher, and that's when the bell rang, so I would always call him at the end of the day. And he'd always say, "Did you listen to that story?" And I said, "I did." And then we never talked about it. But in that story was some answer or solution of somebody who had walked through whatever it was I was walking through at the time. So this is a valuable, valuable service. And we get into gimmicks and bells and whistles. But, you know, listen to the speakers tonight, or not tonight, wherever you are. And you know what? Lee travels at his own expense many times to come and tape these conferences. And you can get, if I don't know, I'm so still outdated. It started with tapes and then CDs. And now, you know, you can even get flash drives. And that's what I do. I pass down what was done to me, and one of my girls is going to go serve time in jail. And I have no experience serving time in jail as a sober member. She's going in with 6 months of sobriety, and she's going to be serving some time. But I have a friend in AA, and I got her tape, and I gave her that CD. And my friend, I won't mention her name from the podium, told that girl how you get through 6 years in prison as a sober member of AA. So please go visit his tapes and his things and try to give your sponsees that gift. I don't know the price you paid for your seat here tonight in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the price I paid for that seat or any seat in any room of Alcoholics Anonymous is I laid down my little 5-year-old son and my little 6-year-old daughter for the price of a drink. Because a clear liquid called vodka that looked no more or less innocuous than the water in this water bottle was so powerful over my mind, it was more powerful than the love a mother had for her own 2 children. And I will never be proud to share that. You know, I want to backtrack too, and I want to thank my husband for joining me. You know, I didn't drink away a 21-year marriage. I sobered away a 21-year marriage because the same selfishness and self-centeredness that I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous with, I carried into my sobriety. At first, it was always about me and child custody, me and the courts, me getting my kids back, me, me, me. And when I became sober, it became about me and my meetings, me and sponsoring people, me and speaking, me, me, me. And the same husband that I abandoned in drunkenness, I abandoned in sobriety. And, you know, he really had become number one in my heart, but it never translated to my actions. And I lost a 21-year marriage in sobriety. And Patrick was just my little buddy. You know, he knew me. He saw me come in. Patrick, if he doesn't pick up a drink in a cup about 10 days, he's going to take a chip for 43 years. And the reason why I want to share that is, you know, I'm... Between my husband, my son, and I, we have 80 years of drinks undrunk in our home because of Alcoholics Anonymous. So don't think that I am not the biggest fan of this program. Like Tara said, you know, they saved my life, they saved my husband's life, they saved my kid's life, and it passes through. So anyway, I did want to say that, but I drank away my 2 children, and I don't want that to be my story. You know, one time I spoke in Seattle, and my husband was sick, and he couldn't go with me, so my daughter came. And when I was done speaking, people, you know, line up and shake the speaker's hand, and this guy walked up to my daughter, she was about 21 at the time, and he said, "Man, your mom has one of the greatest stories in AA, and my kid didn't miss a beat." And she said, "Not if you were her kid." You know, and here I am thinking I'm coming to Seattle to carry the message, and my kid carried the message to me. Because even at 21, it still hurts, you know. And thank God she's 38 years old today and a mom and a wife, but I still see the scars from my drinking, and I don't ever want to forget that. I had a pretty normal childhood up until I was about 9. I had a mom, a dad, a sister, and a nice, beautiful home. My dad was president of the Chamber of Commerce, really well known in the community. My dad owned a local ice skating rink. Both my mom and dad were professional athletes, and they both came to America with Holiday on Ice as professional ice skaters, and both of them had competed in the Olympics prior to becoming pros and getting paid to ice skate. And so every kid in our neighborhood either played soccer, hockey at my dad's ice rink, or they took figure skating lessons. So my family was really well known. Well, at 9 years old, my mom and dad went through an extremely acrimonious divorce. It was over infidelity. It was extremely ugly, very acrimonious, a lot of anger. And that's the first time I started to show that selfish, self-centered fear of needing to control the outsides in the dialogue. And Cliff shared about it, you know, we're like an actor and a director in our own lives. And for some reason, at 9 years old, I was so self-conscious that my parents were getting a divorce and that my mom had had an affair that I kind of assigned myself the role of being the bow on the package in my family. So I just became this like really tightly wound, intense little nine-year-old. And I would go to school and I couldn't get a B, like I had to get A's. And back then tennis was in its heyday in Los Angeles, that's where I'm originally from. And you know, I started coming home from school every day and I started going to this tennis complex that was built across the street from where we lived. It had 16 tennis courts. And I would go and just pick up balls and help this guy clean up. And this tennis pro, he was a retired tennis pro put in charge of this complex. And he could see I was a troubled kid at nine. I wasn't playing out with the kids, the other nine-year-old kids. I was either studying and making A's or like trying to practice tennis and just this intense little kid. And I knew he knew I was a troubled kid, so he saw I had some hand-eye coordination. And I do come from a long line of athletes, so I was an athletic little kid. And because I was helping him clean up, and they had a lot of pro celebrity matches there, and I just made myself the ball girl. And I got all whites, and I'd run back and forth and throw the balls to the players, and they were all televised. And I was just this like nine-year-old that didn't even act ever like a nine-year-old. Anyway, he started to coach me, and by the time I was 12, I started to get a lot of local rankings in California as this tennis pro, or as this upcoming tennis protege. And somewhere in my little head, I came up with this plan that I'm going to become a world-famous tennis pro, and I'm going to make a boatload of money, and I'm going to support my mom and my sister in the way that we deserve, because my dad wouldn't pay child support, and they were always in court, and there was all this acrimony. And I'm not kidding you, I followed that script all the way up into young adulthood. Like, I was just laser-focused on, I'm going to be a tennis pro. You know, and so I would eat brown rice and yogurt and kashi for breakfast, and I'd do all these drills, and again, I'm going to school, and I cannot get a B, I have to get an A, and I probably, like, really needed a drink at 9 years old. I was just not a relaxed kid. Anyway, a byproduct of that divorce was that I had to start spending the weekends with my dad. I have always been afraid of my dad. I didn't know why I felt that, even as a little kid. But my fears were founded when I was 12. Our stories disclose in a general way. I'm not going to go into any graphic detail, but let's just say if you were a girl and you had a budding teenage body, you definitely were not safe to be alone for the weekend with my dad. My mom had tried to commit suicide right after the divorce, and that traumatized me so much that I did not want to tell my mom what was going on with my dad because I felt like she wouldn't be able to handle it and maybe do something stupid. So again, here I am, nine. I'm trying to control the narrative of our family to the public. I'm trying to make sure my mom doesn't hear anything bad about my dad. I got to get straight A's because I got to make our family look like we're normal because we're not. And, you know, looking back, they talk about that in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm already trying to control everything. And I don't understand that because I don't know what an alcoholic is, and I've certainly never picked up a drink. Anyway, that goes on for a while. But during that time, every once in a while, I would just go off the deep end and act out like this crazy little adolescent kid. And I would tear my room apart and have temper tantrums. And again, I'm a total health nut. I don't drink. I don't use drugs. But every once in a while, I would just go off on these tangents, tear my room apart, ditch school, run away, sleep at friends' houses, and that's when I did start to get into drinking a little bit. And I'm described in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, as an alcoholic that's never mildly intoxicated. I'm always more or less insanely drunk. So about every time I drank, I would cause some type of public spectacle And there was no hiding my drinking. I don't like the taste of alcohol. I never liked the taste of alcohol. I'm an alcoholic that drinks solely for the effect. And toward the end, I was so physically allergic to alcohol that if I smelled the vodka before I could guzzle it down, I'd start to retch and gag, and I couldn't keep it down, and I'd puke it up. And toward the end of my drinking, I used to have to plug my nose, uncap the vodka, down it as quickly as I could, recap the bottle, and just pray that that would just warm up my chest and stay down long enough to produce that sense of ease and comfort that they talk about in the book that alcohol, you know, can produce for those of us that are alcoholic. So I was kind of a gooky alcoholic because I would, like, not drink and then drink and get into trouble. Well, both times when I drank, you know, coming up as a kid and dealing with my dad, I ended up getting arrested for public drunkenness, like both times. And both times they put me in one of those adolescent lockdown facilities because, you know, I was just really acting crazy and angry and fighting cops. And the big pink elephant is they'd walk me into these adolescent facilities and I'm cussing like a drunken sailor, fighting cops, acting like the fool. And within 24 hours of sobering up, the diagnosis would become emotional and mental disorders, trauma due to childhood, post-traumatic stress syndrome. They never even addressed the drinking. So that happened twice before you know, I even became like 15 years old. I did not want to do high school because now I'm going to be a tennis pro and I've got a plan and I'm organizing life. And that tennis coach that had been coaching me said that I'm not getting enough competitive play at my level in high school. So he asked me if I wanted to take the GED exam so that maybe if I pass it, I can start, you know, enrolling in a local junior college and start doing college play. And I really liked, you know, I trusted this guy because I had no relationship with my dad. And he even said, you know, Tammy, I may talk your mom and I have a condominium with an extra unit. And since I'm training you every day after school now and you are favored to win the junior pro circuit this year. So he said, let's try to get you into college. You can come and stay with me. I'm going to train you and let's see if we can make your dream a reality. So I take this GED exam, and I'm like Cliff. I'm a really good test taker. In fact, I just retired from a 26-year career as a high school English teacher in sobriety. Go figure. I taught your kids. I taught your grandkids. That should scare you. So I take this GED exam, and I find out 6 weeks later that indeed I passed the exam. So he takes me down to a local junior college, and I try out for the tennis team, and I'm good enough to play number 2 varsity string. And at 16 years old, he walks me over to admissions and records, and he enrolls me in 12 units at 16 years old. So now I'm 16 years old, and I cannot get a B. I have to get an A. And I'm playing, and I'm doing drills, and I'm starting to win awards for that tennis team. And at 18 years old, I received something called the Chancellor's Award, where the chancellor of the school picked a few students that demonstrated some type of academic and or athletic excellence. And that Chancellor's Award gave me a certificate that I could go to any one of 5 state universities, and they showed me all 5 were good universities. And for 2 more years, as long as I played on their tennis team and took a minimum of 12 units, those universities were offering to pay my tuition, my housing, my textbook, and my living expenses. And guess what I did, guys? There you go. I quit. Because the book says that we have special skills, aptitudes, and abilities, that we can not only build a bright outlook for ourselves, but for our loved ones, and then we pull the whole thing down over our head with a senseless series of sprees. And so I didn't understand that, you know, at 18 years old when I graduated that first, you know, 2-year college, because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. But again, in that college, I had gone off on a binge, and both times again, I got arrested for public drunkenness, and both times again, they put me in one of those lockdown facilities, and both times, the whole focus was on childhood trauma and not my drinking. Anyway, at 18 years old, I intuitively knew at a very, very visceral level that there was no way I could impose the discipline and the structure that I have to impose upon myself to not pick up a drink. I'm 18 years old. I have to make straight A's. I'm eating brown rice and yogurt and kashi for breakfast. I'm working out. Everything was so regimented. At 18 years old, I was flipping exhausted. You know, I'm going to be 65 years old in a couple of months, and I was more tired at 18 than I am now because I just could not relax or breathe. Anyway, so I all of a sudden just gave up on the whole tennis thing, and then I did what I'm really, really talented at, which is bad drinking and bad relationships. And back in L.A. in the late 80s, you know, if you were a girl and you had blonde hair, blue eyes, tan skin, a white tooth smile, and a really good tennis game, there was a whole lot of places that you can go and hang out with older men, and they were willing to buy you things and pay your way, and that's what I did for the next couple of years. Now, I had moved in with that tennis coach, and he was 40, and I was 15 when I actually moved in with him and turned 16 shortly after. And sadly to say, he fell to the temptation. I was a very precocious, sexualized 16-year-old for obvious reasons, and he had become my live-in boyfriend over those years. And he had supported me from 15, and now I'm in my early 20s, paying my tuition, paying my textbooks, and he was my boyfriend, and I was just a kid, and now he's in his mid-40s. Anyway, so I start hanging out, like, at the Malibu Tennis Club and Marina Del Rey, and these are places in L.A., and Hugh Hefner at the Playboy Mansion used to pay his scouts to come and pay me a couple hundred dollars to come and play at the Playboy Mansion because they had these big celebrity tennis matches. So I'd do that. I was always dressed, and no, I never saw the grotto. But this is like the life I'm living, you know, and I'm just a young kid. Like, I have no experience. Anyway, it was during this time that I met the man that went on to be my husband for 21 years. His name is, I call him Dr. Rick. His name is Rick. And I'm living with my tennis pro boyfriend, and I'm just flitting around. I'm not going to school. I'm just playing tennis and flirting with men and getting whatever it is I can get. And this really handsome doctor moves into the condominium right next door to ours. There's literally, we shared a wall. And I see this guy, and he's wearing a triathlete shirt, and I notice him, and he noticed me, and right away I'm like, ding, 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 right? And, you know, the fact I'm living with another guy next door for 7 years paying my rent, yeah, that's just an incidental, you know how we roll, right? And I start flirting with Dr. Rick, and poor Dr. Rick met me in a swearing-off period because I was going through a time where things weren't going well, and I was swearing off alcohol. Now, I have this little thing, Bad Girl Tammy, and Bad Girl Tammy chases me. And I have to keep upping the ante. She chases me, she catches me, I get in trouble, I end up in adolescent units, and then it's like, I'm going to do even more to keep Bad Girl Tammy away. So my decision at this time is, look, the tennis career didn't pan out, and maybe that 12 units wasn't enough, but I seem to be doing better when I was in college than when I'm not. So I decide this time I'm going to become a triathlete. Maybe that'll be the difference. And instead of taking 12 units, I'm going to enroll in a local college and take 15 units, and maybe I can turn my life around. Because like Taryn said, you know, we're always trying to fix the outsides to temper these crazy, crazy little insides. And the book says that when the spiritual malady is overcome, that's when we straighten out mentally and physically. But I'm going to psychiatrists to try to have them help me fix the way I think and the things I do. And I'm going to medical doctors to give me something because I'm depressed all the time. I can't sleep at night. I have insomnia. I'm anxious. I can't handle life on life's terms. And I keep going to the medical model for a solution, but I'm spiritually maladjusted. You know, here's my spirit, and this is maladjusted. And I don't know why. There is not a chapter in the book that says why it works. But when I come and sit with you good people and I do what we do here, for some reason it just it adjusts my spirit and keeps me aligned. So that's why I keep coming back. Anyway, I'm trying to play footsies with this doctor next door. And the very next day, I sign him up at my gym, and he's spotting me on weights, and we're working out together, and then we're running 10Ks together in the local city. And every Wednesday, he has off his medical practice. And so we're laying out by the pool, you know, flirting away and stuff, and I'm living with my boyfriend, paying my rent, because that's how I roll. I have absolutely no conscience or morality when I'm drinking. Anyway, poor old Rick just found me to be very engaging and athletic and enterprising. But one night my boyfriend came home and we got into shooters of tequila. I call it tequila if you're an alcoholic of my type. And I just decided, you know, I've been studying hard and working out hard. A couple of shooters won't harm me. And I went into one of those blackouts that we go into. And we got into one of those knockdown, drag-out fights. And, you know, I may only be 5 foot 1 inches tall on a good day, but they used to call me Tammy Tyson because when I drink, I like to fight people. And I got into this knockdown, drag-out fight with my boyfriend, and it was so loud that Dr. Rick heard it between the walls, and so he called the police. And the police show up to our condominium, and Rick said later he was surprised they never asked what unit it was. They knew. And I see, you know, my boyfriend talking to the police, and I see Dr. Rick behind the police saying, is Tammy okay? Is Tammy okay? You know, and I'm on the couch, drunker than a skunk. And Dennis, my boyfriend gets rid of the police, and he gets rid of Dr. Rick, and then Dennis and I go upstairs, do one of those all-night passionate makeups we do after we beat the crap out of each other, and the police show up, and then the police leave, and it's like, oh my God, you're my soulmate, I love you. Because we're so whack, and we're so dramatic. And we spend the night, professing our love to each other like a bad Hallmark card. But I wake up the next morning and I do exactly what's described in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that after a while a drinking alcoholic cannot separate the true from the false. The only life we come to understand is our drinking life, and I thought nothing the next morning of taking a little liquid makeup, covering up the marks on my face from the night fight the night before, and believe me, I was way more the aggressor, taking a backpack on my back and going off to Cal State University Northridge like there is nothing wrong with my life. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm parking in that subterranean parking complex in that condominium unit that I'm living in. And I get out of my car, and I'm walking toward the elevator, and life hurts. I am hungover because I drank the night before. My boyfriend and I had been very physical with each other, so my whole body physically aches. I've been sitting in classes all day listening to lectures, and my brain hurts. And my back is rigid, my jaw is tight, and I'm just walking toward the elevator one more time saying, life is just so freaking hard. And all of a sudden, a thought occurs to me at the elevator. There's a huge bottle of vodka waiting for me on my kitchen counter, and all I have to do is go up 3 flights and go to my door, and liquid relief is just moments away. Now, I haven't seen that vodka. I haven't smelled the vodka. I certainly haven't tasted the vodka. But thinking about a liquid that looks no more innocuous than the water right here that I'm holding up, all of a sudden my jaw relaxes, my back loosens up, I got a hop in my step, and life feels good again. And if you identify with that, you're probably an alcoholic. Because alcohol has a voice for us that it doesn't have for other people. Anyway, I get to that elevator and liquid relief's a-coming, and right when I go to push button number 3, there's Dr. Rick right at the doors. So now I'm switching to the closed door button because I don't want to be stuck in an elevator with the neighbor that called the police on me the night before, and his hand wedges between those doors, and they open up and he walks in and he says, Tammy, you and I need to talk about what happened last night. And prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and having a guy like Clancy tell me, do you eat with your filthy mouth? And I'm like, yeah, what the F are you talking about? And he goes, clean up your filthy language, Tammy. We're a spiritual program, and we have to be willing to grow along spiritual lines. And I made the mistake of telling Clancy, okay, I'm going to work on that. And he goes, no, baby girl, you want to work on it, go to therapy. In AA, when you know better, you do better. And he helped me clean up my language. I used to use a tremendous amount of inappropriate sexual attire, sexual humor, and sexual body language to keep especially you men a little bit off your footing with me, so you could never just, have an adult intimate conversation with me because I don't know how to do that. So Rick makes this comment, and I pull out the tough, brash street girl. I'm like, Dr. Rick, you effing know what's going on. Man, you're the one that called the effing police on me last night, and I don't want to effing talk about it. And instead of him doing the usual, like, whoa, 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 okay, he took his hand and he put it on my shoulder, and he just looked me in the eye. And that really disarmed me because I'm used to just backing people off with my brash behavior. So I realized, like, the tough cussing girl isn't going to work. And he's got his hand on my shoulder, and he always dressed impeccably. And I just remember grabbing his silk fastenal tie and yanking his neck right into my nose and taking a big whiff and going, my God, Dr. Rick, you just smell so delicious. And he didn't bite that bait either. And he put his other hand on my other shoulder, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, sweetheart, he said, you are such an enterprising, engaging young woman. And he says, I have really come to care for you. And as a friend and a doctor, I can tell you're struggling with something, and I want to help you, but I don't know what's wrong with you. And man, that's the worst thing you can hear if you're an alcoholic suffering from alcoholism, because I have always known there's something wrong with me. Talk about the bedevilments. I've always been bedeviled. There's just something wrong with me, and I've been in enough therapy and lockdown units to be told that I'm not wired right because of the 10 years of abuse that I faced at the hand of my dad and that I don't perceive things right. And now I'm in my 20s, and my biggest fear is I know I'm crazy, so I'm just going to pretend my whole life is going to be fake so that you don't know how scared I am that I'm crazy. And now another person has hit me between the eyes with the truth. But see, I'm at the point of my drinking where I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest in my life about the role alcohol plays in my life, the role I play in the lives of other people, and that I'm a complete fraud in every area of my life. But for whatever reason, and today I do know it was God's grace, I got off that elevator and I told Rick the cry of every drinking alcoholic. I told him about my dad. I told him about the foster home I had to go to for a while. I told him about running away, and I told him one day I'm going to finish my education. And one day when I finish my education, I'm going to make my own money. And one day when I make my own money, I won't have to live with abusive men. And one day and one day and one day, because the cry of every drinking alcoholic is, look, I know my life looks a little whack, but I have a plan. And when that plan comes to fruition, it's going to all be okay. And that's why we need to be sponsored, newcomers. That's why we need to be sponsored, you know? And young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to tell you a universal truth that's in these rooms. It's not in the book, so be careful, because this is something you're going to really need to hear. You don't like the old-timers? Don't worry about it. You'll never be one. You know? Our old-timers are some of our most untapped resources. I've just moved to an area where they say time doesn't matter, so we don't care if anybody has time or not. It doesn't matter. Bull hockey. Try to get some time. Try to live, like Cliff said, a life without alcohol over a long period of time and have to do all the work that we have to do so that we don't have to use this to produce ease and comfort. So anyway, I left that night, and what I will say is I broke down for the first time talking to Dr. Rick like the broken little girl I was and always had been. No more seductress sexual Tammy. No more cuffed, brash, I'm tough Tammy. I broke and I sobbed like the broken kid I was and always had been. And Rick held me, and I let him hold me. And I'm going to tell you today, I'm almost 65 years old. That is one of the most first and most intimate moments that I have ever shared with a man in my life up to that point in my life. Because a man held me, and I let him, and I trusted him, and I felt comforted. And I'm going to tell you, there's many, many gentle, gentle men in Alcoholics Anonymous that have provided that for me, too. I'm not one that goes to, like, women's meetings and all that, and I have no opinion on it for anybody else. But I'll tell you, more of the men in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to be a lady, taught me how to dress and talk appropriately, and taught me how to be a mom to my kids. Because when the women said mean things to me, I just say, they're just jealous. But when the men said stuff like, why don't you dress like a mom instead of a two-bit whore? That hurt my feelings, and I heard it. And I'm so grateful to the people that cared more about my life than they did about my feelings in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I go home that night, and I never did get that drink of vodka I'd been thinking about in the elevator. And I actually slept for the first time without drinking myself to sleep that night in a long time. I think all that crying and just letting that go after 22 years of just always being, like, so controlled. And I slept peacefully that night, but I woke up the next morning, and I felt the fear they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that fear that comes in 100 different forms. And that fear that controls our thoughts and our actions and our behavior. And I did the only thing an alcoholic knows how to do when they feel that fear. And they don't have a God to pray to for strength. And they don't have friends like a lot of these people sitting here that I could just call Diane. You know, Lori, can I talk to you? I got some dumb fears. I just need to talk them through. And I went to the only thing that took away the big owl, and I poured that vodka the next morning. You know, I plugged my nose, I downed it, it heated up my chest, it produced that sense of ease and comfort, and then I came up with a drunken plan. And the only thing worse than a sober plan is a drunken plan. And my plan that morning was, things were really spiraling down the drain with my current boyfriend and I, and I was an albatross, and I knew my days were numbered with him. But that rich Dr. Surgeon, I could tell he was a nice guy and very compassionate, but I also could tell he had a crush on me. So my plan was to just take everything out of the condominium unit that I had with my boyfriend and move it into Dr. Rick's next door. I had the key to his condo because he had these exotic fish, and when he'd go to medical conferences, I used to take care of his exotic fish. So I spent the day drunk moving. And when Dennis came home, my boyfriend came home that afternoon, there I weren't. I just moved everything out, like just gone. You know, and he came home to that, and that was, you know, he had taken care of me for 7 years. You know, was he a weak man, and did he fall to temptation? Yes, but he was not a bad human being, and he suffered many, many years over his actions in that. And he's probably been one of my biggest cheerleaders that I made it in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when he saw me losing my kids and what I was going through, he felt very responsible for that. And so I just moved out on him. And Dr. Rick came home that afternoon, and there I were, all moved in. And are there any, can the Al-Anons raise their hands? Al-Anons? Okay, Al-Anons, you're going to get this. They won't. I don't. But Dr. Rick not only let me stay, but 3 weeks later, he walked me down the aisle, and he said, I do. And the day that he said, I do, was the day he qualified for Al-Anon, because his life was never the same. You know, it's painful for me to share this, and it took a lot of inventory, but I punished Dr. Rick for everything that my dad had ever done to me. And I punished him for everything that weak men that didn't have good boundaries had done to me. And because he was pre-Al-Anon at the time, he sadly took the butt kicking, and I darn near destroyed his soul. You know, Dr. Rick grew up in an extremely abusive alcoholic home. His way of getting out of pain was through academia, and he was so bright. He made it to high school at 12. He made it to college at 16. He made it to medical school at 20. And at 24 years old, think about it, those of you that have kids, at 24 years old, he was an air flight surgeon at the tail end of the Vietnam War, sewing our boys' bodies up as a 24-year-old when they're being blown apart and medevaced off the fields. He was married for 10 years, and he went through a tough childhood, that war, medical school, you know, a difficult marriage with a son, you know, that was extremely disabled, and he survived all of that. Yet being married to me for just a couple of years, he was stuttering and stammering, and he didn't know his own shadow, because I'm not a funny drunk. I hurt people, and I hurt him. And his biggest crime was he really wanted to just help me. Anyway, that marriage produced two children, and today I have a daughter, Chelsea, that's 37, and my son, Alex, is 36. I'm sure some of you are surprised because they grew up in, you know, giving me cakes and AA all these years, and now they're young adults themselves. My son also has 8.5 years of sobriety, and that was, yeah. And I'll tell you, that was 15 years of hell, being a sober member of AA and being to help the girls I sponsor, and I couldn't help my own kid, but that's a story for another day. But that was a difficult part of my sobriety. But that marriage produced two children, and I was so physically sick with both my pregnancies. I had a condition called hyperemesis. I couldn't keep food down. I couldn't stand the smell of perfume, cut flowers, and I couldn't stand the smell of alcohol. So I go 9 months pregnant with my daughter, and I give birth to her. And 6 weeks after I give birth to my daughter, I find out I'm pregnant again, this time with my son, Alex. Dr. Rick hates me sharing that. He's an OB. You're supposed to wait like at least 12 weeks. And so I literally went another 9 months straight without picking up a drink. And if you do not believe this disease is, or this malady is progressive, I woke up one morning and I had not had a drink in over 26 months. I have a brand new little baby boy, a 1-year-old baby girl. I have a 5-bedroom house with a pool, basketball courts, married to a surgeon, 4 cars in the garage paid for. And I felt the fear they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, because I got these two little kids looking at me, and I am so painfully aware that I am a completely crippled human being playing imposter in this adult life, and I felt the fear they talk about in this book. And I did the only thing we know how to do, and I picked up a drink. The book says that many women, in particular, cross beyond recognition in a short period of time. And within 1 year, I became a falling down, knocked down, getting arrested, full-time drunken mother. And I'll tell you, you want to know a definition of hell, be a drunken mom or be a drunken parent for that. I don't mean to prioritize. Anyway, things got so bad that, again, I'm starting to show up in nut houses and lockdown facilities. I'm damn near ruined my husband's medical career. He was a very prominent OBGYN in Northridge where we lived. And, you know, it was a nightmare. Anyway, it got to the point where one day, he starts going to Al-Anon, and one day he comes home and he says, Tammy, you can go to a hell in a handbasket if you want to, but you're not going to take Chelsea and Alex and I for this ride anymore if you don't get help. And I saw something in his eyes that night, and I knew those Al-Anons were giving him a backbone to finally stand up to the insidiousness of my drinking. And I felt that fear they talk about in the book. And I picked a fight with him that night. And I went down to the liquor store and I bought a little fifth of vodka. And I did my deal. And when the alcohol took effect, I saw a call box on the freeway. And I'm driving on the freeway. And for some reason, I thought the call box was a payphone. And I plowed my car into that call box. And 30 days later, I'm standing in front of a woman judge. And she's looking at my rap sheet, and she said, "You know, Tammy, your rich doctor surgeon husband isn't going to buy you out of jail time on this one. You're going to serve some time. However, I'm going to put you in a lockdown facility for 30 days for treatment of alcoholism." And I went into that treatment center, and those doctors told me what they'd been telling me since I first started appearing in lockdown units. I told them, "Look, first I drank to feel good, then I drank to feel normal, and now I drink not to feel." And those doctors told me, "Tammy, you're clinically depressed because of your childhood, and your drinking is just self-medicating, and none of this is your fault." Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, the old-timers had a new name for the effect that alcohol appeared to have on me, as described word for word in the doctor's opinion of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and which Cliff so eloquently described, you know, that I have a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession, and they said that I may be alcoholic. I told those doctors that I'd wake up in the morning and I'd go downstairs after a blackout and I'd see broken children, broken glass, broken husband, a broken home, and broken dreams. I'd just go back upstairs, turn the heating blanket up to mom, suck my thumb, and lay in bed and think of ways to kill myself. In that lockdown unit, they told me that the best hope for a person like me is the right combination of medications for depression, anxiety, and whatever, insomnia, but that none of these actions are my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, Clancy had a new name for a mother that was willing to, you know, take her own life or lay in bed and be suicidal without giving a flying crap how it would affect those two kids. He called it alcoholism, selfishness, self-centeredness. The world is still revolving about Tammy's childhood pain. Forget my kids are in their childhood. I'm still sucking my thumb and drinking at mine. In that lockdown facility, I told those doctors that in my swearing off periods, I'd join a local gym and work out with all you men, of course. And then I'd take his credit card and buy drinks on the house or lunch on my husband's dime, always playing the big shot, taking credit for money I never earned. And in that lockdown facility, they told me that buying attention from men and acceptance was really my way of buying back that love from my father that I'd never received in my childhood. But none of those actions are my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, the old-timers had a name for that, too. They called it stealing. Yeah. Not only did I steal my husband's hard-earned money and play big shot on his dime for money I never earned, but as a wife and a mother of two small children, I used to take the men I met at those daytime gyms, and I used to take them to those daytime motels. And let's just say I did what alcoholic women drunken do in those daytime motels. And in that lockdown facility, they told me that my dad gave me a script when I was a kid, that my only worth was my sexuality. So all I was doing in those daytime motels was acting out a script I'd been so poorly given in my childhood, but none of those actions in those motel rooms were my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, these old-timers had a new name for that, too. They called it cheating. By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned that living inside of me was this hurt, wounded child due to a broken family and discontented abuse at home. And for a buck in a basket, these old-timers said, "No, baby girl, you're a liar, you're a cheat, you're a thief, and you may just be an alcoholic suffering from alcoholism." And God, I needed it to be so much more. And I want to make it very clear, I am not against any outside help. They talk about it in the book, and I am not against medications, okay? I have a son that was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and he's sober in AA, and God help the idiot in AA that tells my son to go off his medications, right? So I want to be very clear that I'm telling my story up here, and I was misdiagnosed. Condition of my getting out of that lockdown facility is I have to start attending Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I come to meetings late. I leave meetings early. I wear low-cut tops and little Daisy Duke shorts. I was a lot younger then. And I took five of those 30-day chips, but I'll never forget my last surrender because I took a fifth 30-day chip, and I met this guy at the meeting, and he and I went to the liquor store and had a few drinks to celebrate my fifth 30-day chip. And 30 days later, or 3 days later, I came to, and when I came home, there was a note on the door and a package, and my mother, my husband, and my sister had gone down to family court in that 3-day run, and to this day, almost 31 years later, I have no recollection of where I went in those 3 days or what I did. I know I reeked of alcohol, and the whole side of my face had like gravel, like wiped, it was all wiped out. And I get this restraining order, and the whole house is locked up, and the locks are changed. And I call my husband, Rick, and he said, "Tammy, I have a restraining order on you that says that you cannot come within 100 yards of me, of our medical practice, of Alex's daycare, of Chelsea's kindergarten, or of our home. You need to go find a place to stay, and when you find a permanent residence to live in, I will send you every money. I will send you money every month, but for God's sakes, woman, it's over, and just leave me and the kids alone." And I told him, "But I need to get some stuff, and now I'm in this panic mode." And he said, "Tammy, you can come to the house at 7 o'clock tonight when I'm off work, and you can pack up a few things and make sure you find a place to go, because I'm not taking care of this anymore." And I want you to know that at 7 o'clock that night, somewhere during the day, I just kind of went into this comatose state. And I had no fight left, no mouth, no defending, no deflecting, no stories of what happened to me. I literally died spiritually that afternoon, just sitting in the clubhouse at my AA meeting, realizing that I have just lost everything that I really loved and wanted to be good for, and I just couldn't. And I went to the house at 7 o'clock, and Rick opened the door, and he said, "Tammy, Chelsea and Alex are in their bedrooms, and they're asleep." He said, "Your mom and I have been calling morgues and hospitals for 3 days looking for you, and your kids have been through hell and back. So you can go get some stuff, and you go stay somewhere tonight." And he said, "But for once in your life, woman, do not wake up those children." And so I went upstairs, and I was like a walking dead person. I remember moving, like, up the stairs, and this ringing, this buzzing was in my ears. But I was literally void of any emotion whatsoever. And I got my gym bag, and I threw some sweats and some T-shirts and some shoes in the gym bag. And so I went out to the hall. Dr. Rick was just looking down at his feet. You know, he was watching me, you know, because he wanted to protect my kids' bedrooms, because he didn't know if I was going to show up intoxicated or not. And I looked up at him, and it took everything in my soul. But I didn't fight him. I wasn't angry. I looked at him, and I just said, "Rick, I know I need to go. And I wanted to go. I knew I needed to go." And I said, "But would you at least just let me say goodbye to Chelsea and Alex before I leave?" And he said, "Tammy, again, they've been through hell and back. I will let you look in on them, but you're not to wake them or talk to them." And on April 23rd, 1993, I grabbed the handle to my son Alex's bedroom door. And as I opened up the door, the hall light went right down. Onto my son. My son was 5. And I saw Alex for the first time the way a mother sees a child. I see it today. I remember just looking at him. And he looked just like his handsome dad. And he was asleep, and he had his little lips. And he looked so peaceful, and he looked so little and so innocent. And I just felt this love for this little person. And I just started to walk toward him, and I literally felt like a monster walking toward an angel. And I sat down on his bed, and it's like something was just guiding my body. And he opened up... He opened up his eyes, and he started to rub my hand. And my 5-year-old looked at me, and in his little quiet voice, he said, "Mama," he goes, "when are you going to come home and stay with us and not go away anymore?" And in that instant, I was willing to be willing to do whatever it took. I know it, like I'm standing here tonight. It wasn't the divorce. It wasn't my childhood. It wasn't the abuse. Everything that was going wrong in my life was over a clear liquid. For God's sakes, this is over a liquid and substances. And I just looked at my little kid, and I said a prayer in my head that I believe every alcoholic needs to say for themselves. Don't say it for your mom or your dad or your kids or your psychiatrist or even your sponsor. But for some reason in my head, I just said, "God, please help me." And for me, you know, I didn't have some white light experience, but I remember this heat in my chest. And I remember taking in a deep breath and feeling like I could breathe for the first time in my life. And I remember leaving that night, and I've got like a hefty bag and a gym bag of clothes, and I'm going to go stay in the back of my home group. And here I am, a surgeon's wife with a 5-bedroom house, beautiful hardwood floors, all these cars, and I'm going to sleep in this old van that this guy used to leave in the back of the Hole in the Sky where I got sober for wet drunks that needed a place to stay that couldn't afford a hotel. And I want to let you know, I slept in that van that night, and that I don't think I ever felt more at peace than I did that night. And you hit on that, Tara. Something filled in me, and I felt like this hope. And somehow when I came into AA with my low-cut tops and my high-cut shorts and flirting with you men and the old-timers telling their sponsees, stay the hell away from that blonde girl, Tammy, she's bad news, somewhere you still carried the message to a drunken alcoholic, because when I was ready, I knew that those people in AA could help me. And the next morning, this mean old timer, Cowboy Nick, started to unlock the home group, and I crawled out of that van. And again, I'd been drinking for 3 days. I smelled, I reeked of alcohol. And I didn't say, I need money, or I need a place to stay, or my story. I just said, Nick, I just lost my kids, my husband, my house. Can you show me how to stop drinking? And that's magic words to our old timers. And he said, sweetheart, your arms are too short to box with God. Why don't you put out your hand and let us help you? And I grabbed his hand that day. And I haven't had a drink since, you know? You know, through the grace of God, the program of alcoholics in Al-Anon, my husband became a very active member of Al-Anon. I love Al-Anon. I am not an Al-Anon, but I do not take kindly to Al-Anon jokes. And I don't think I really, really understood what it's like to be a loved one of an alcoholic or to love an alcoholic until 15 years after I got sober, my boy fell so hard to this thing. And I'll tell you, man, that brought me to my knees. You know, the whole time I was drinking, my family went through it sober. I was drunk. I wasn't feeling any pain. They were. But when I had to walk through it sober with my boy, you know, Al-Anons, I salute you, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for you, and I love conferences that include our Al-Anon brothers and sisters because they're necessary. You know, in sobriety, I remember saying, you know, when I had a year sober, through the grace of God and Al-Anon in the courts, they awarded me custody back of my children. We don't promise you that here in Alcoholics Anonymous, but you got a hell of a better chance of being reunited with lost family members if you be sober. I got to be a sober mom to those two kids. I learned how to go back to school, and instead of taking 15 units and 12 units, I remember saying to Clancy, I'm going back to school, and I'm taking 15 units. And he's like, good, a-hole, now go drop 11 of them. He said, kid, you know, you're... He goes, let me make something very clear. You don't gear your busy or AA around your busy little life. You gear your busy little life around AA. And he said, yeah, so he said, you're bodily and mentally different from other people, Tammy, and you can do anything you want to do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but you have to do it sober. And if you start taking classes, I'm going to get those calls. I have finals. I have too many units. I have this, and you're going to start missing your meetings. Talk about being educated beyond my intelligence, which Clancy's always told me. It took me 18 flipping years, but I stand before you. I not only have one, check this out, I have 2 master's degrees. Wait, and this is funnier. I came in here drunk, cussing like a drunken sailor and dressing like a 2-bit whore. Do you know what I did the last 26 years? I'm an English language arts teacher, man. I taught your kids the art of language. Snap, right? Check that out. I'm going to end in sharing that Dr. Rick made an Al-Anon mistake. All of a sudden, I'm 12 years sober. I'm a sober wife. I'm taking care of the kids. I'm working. I'm contributing to the family income. And he decided, he got really busy. It was his OBGYN practice. We built it up really big. And he made a fatal mistake that my problem is solved because Tammy's sober. After 2 years of not going to Al-Anon, he starts going through this midlife crisis or whatever, and he comes home one day and he tells me, Tammy, I've met another woman. She's younger than you, she's prettier than you, and she's more fun than you, and I thought I was going to die. And I was so busy in Alcoholics Anonymous speaking and sponsoring and doing this, this, and that. The real truth was is that he was never number one as far as he was concerned in his head. He was in mine, but it never translated to my actions. And that's why in this second marriage, everywhere I speak, Patrick goes with me. When Patrick speaks, I go with him. My husband's just recently had his whole voice box removed. He had stage 4 throat cancer. And but he's right here cheering me on because I don't want to make the same mistake and leave him at home, and he doesn't leave me at home. And we do this together. And you know what the good news is? I want my husband to be with me. I enjoy being with my husband, you know? I went through that painful divorce, and Clancy walked me through that, and he told me that that's your kid's prince, and you're their princess, and I don't care whether he's cheated on you, no matter what it is, he's left you for another woman, you don't need to be sharing that on the podiums, he's an OBGYN, that's not good for his practice in the community, and you are never to badmouth him to your children, and I was so grateful for that. Rick and I, eventually that woman dumped him, and he was so brokenhearted that Patrick and I were the ones that were there to kind of walk him through that. And he learned that, you know, I have an affinity for alcohol. Well, he has an affinity for pretty little alcoholic women. He didn't leave me for just an alcoholic. I swear she was worse alcoholic than I was. And he went running back to Al-Anon. Anyway, I get a call in 2013 from my daughter, and she said, Mom, Daddy's medical assistant just called, and he hasn't shown up to work for 2 days. Dr. Rick never missed a day of work in 42 years. And I said, Chelsea, something's wrong, but they called Chelsea because she was the next of kin. I called the medical assistant, and I said, something's wrong, and they said he had scrubbed out. He was doing a surgery Friday, and he started to complain of severe back pain, but he had passed a kidney stone like the year before, so he thought it was just another kidney stone, so he finished the surgery and went home, but he didn't answer any of his calls over the weekend, and you can't do that when you're an OBGYN, and then he didn't go to work Monday or Tuesday, so I said, Chelsea, give them permission, go to his house. They went there, the car was there, the lights were on, the TV was playing, and he didn't answer the door. We finally gave them permission to break in, and they found Dr. Rick on the floor in a coma, barely alive, fully septic. And they rushed him to the hospital, and Dr. Rick apparently was suffering the effects of Agent Orange. They put him on life support, and they called me and Patrick and the kids, and they said, he's not viable with life. We'll keep him on life support so you can bring your kids to come and say goodbye to their dad. But there is no way that he can survive this. He was in complete organ failure. So I go to the hospital with my kids, and I called Clancy, and he said, Tammy, that's the kid's dad. Now you put on your big girl panties, and you hold their hands, and you walk them in one by one, and you let them say goodbye to their dad. So Chelsea said goodbye, and she was just engaged to be married, and I held her hand, and he was in a coma. He wasn't conscious, tubes everywhere, that machine breathing for him. And she said, Daddy, nobody was supposed to walk you down the aisle except nobody was supposed to walk me down the aisle, and she cried, and I held her hands. Then I brought her out, and Patrick just held her, and I walked my son in, and he just looked at his dad and started to shake, and he couldn't talk, and I held him. Then Patrick went in, and we were in full hazmat suits because he was so septic. And Patrick went in, and he said, Rick, he said, you go on home and take an Emmy for a life well lived because I know you can't live like this. And he said, and I want to reassure you that as long as I'm on God's green earth, I will never let any harm come to you or to Tammy or to your two children. And he said, you go on home and you take your final rest. And then it was my turn, and I went in there and I looked at this guy that saved me in every way that a woman could have been saved. And I look at this beautiful man in this bed, and I remember saying to God, man, like, why him? Why him? He was a good guy. He was a good daddy. He was a good soul. And I just went up to him, and they told me, the nurses told me that he can still hear even though he was in a coma, and to give him permission to let go. And I got up in his ear, and I said, Ricky, I said, you know I'm sober, and I'm going to be there for Chelsea and Alex, and Patrick and I will make sure that your legacy continues through your children. And then I got right up in his ear, and I said, but for God's sakes, buddy, I know you, and if you got even an ounce of this much fight left, you give it your all, and we'll be there every step of the way. Rick didn't die that night. He didn't die the following day. 15 days he stayed on life support, and the diagnosis was the same, that he was not viable with life. On the 15th day, he started to do some stirring and breathing, and they took him off the ventilator about 7 days later, I think it was, and he started to breathe on his own. 5 months in an acute care hospital, they said he's viable with life at this point, but he'll never walk or talk again, and he'll need to be in a skilled nursing facility. And so I talked to Clancy, and he said, Tammy, you just go find a facility near your home, and you and the kids and Patrick go check on him and make sure he gets the care he needs and deserves until the good Lord calls him home, and you put on your big girl panties and do the next indicated thing. And so I'm driving around looking at these nursing homes, and this beautiful man who served our country, who helped so many people in our community that didn't have money and delivered their babies for them, he was such a good guy to me and everybody. And I'm looking at him, looking at these a twin bed and a flipping little dresser next to it, and that's what his life was going to end like. And I call Clancy, and I go, Clancy, what do you do when none of your options are viable? He goes, kid, you do the next indicated thing. And he goes, now you sign a contract to put him in there because it's near your home. And I did, and I'm driving home. And when I got home, our entire cul-de-sac was filled with Patrick's construction trucks. My husband's a contractor. And all these trucks are there. And I walk in the house, and Patrick and his guys had gutted the whole downstairs. They put in hardwood floors. They ordered a $6,000 hospital bed. Patrick revamped the entire shower with pulleys because Rick couldn't stand or anything. And I looked at him, and he said, Tammy, for God's sakes, man, we take in wet drunks. This is the kid's dad. And he said, you know what? He goes, we're going to bring him home and let him spend whatever time he has left with his family. And we brought Dr. Rick home. And through the love of a good ex-wife, and definitely Patrick's cooking, occupational therapy, physical therapy, shower nurses, we did the whole thing. Rick started to improve. Rick lived with us for 6 years. He is still alive. He did the father-daughter dance with Chelsea at a wedding. and I married a good man. And people used to always say to Patrick, man, how can you live with your wife's ex-husband? Patrick used to carry him and shower him, clean his whole body for him. And you know what? That's what recovery looks like on a man that truly works the program. And I'll tell you, man, the men I used to be attracted to bore the crap out of me. But the men that excite me today are good, solid men with integrity, and we have so many of them here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Look, I've gone a bit over, but I'm going to share that I got to teach other people's kids for 26 years, and I drank my own two children away for a year of their own lives, and I got to, through God's grace, I got to teach other people's kids and give back to children, and that was a huge part of my healing. My mom, when she was sick, we brought her in, and she did hospice with Patrick and I, and again, Patrick took her to all her appointments, bathed her, fed her, I got a good guy, and we spoiled that little lady until the good Lord called her home. You know, Dr. Rick, when he got sick, I got to truly make living amends to a man that I had really, really hurt, and his only crime was really loving me. And God, in his infinite wisdom, I don't think there'd be enough alcohol on this earth to assuage the guilt that I would have felt for what I had done. You know, today, my kids asked us, we moved to Northern California because Patrick was diagnosed in 2020, and they told us he had 4 months to live. He had stage 4 laryngeal cancer, and it had spread out to the cartilage. And sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, including my current sponsor, Pat Y, had walked through that with her own husband, and those people were bookends, and they just walked us through that. And my daughter one day said, you know, I'm trying to work full-time to keep the medical insurance and take care of him. And my son had just been diagnosed with schizophrenia, so we had a whole lot of stuff going on. But, you know, we're higher-powered, man, and we could do more than most. More than most, right, Cliff? Anyway, Chelsea came down, flew down. She had moved to Northern California, and she said, Mom, she goes, we're going to lose you before Patrick at the rate you're going. Why don't you come and be with family? And this is a little girl that I drank away. And my husband and I sold our house in Los Angeles, and we took the money, and we bought a house outright in Northern California. We overlook a 100-year-old farm. My daughter and her family and the grandkids of my son, they have separate houses, but we're all together again. You know, how do you get from here to there? I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for God, and I sure as heck thank you to one of you for sitting through this. Thank you so much.